A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
From the glow of St. Paul's number one, welcome to another edition of Cabin Country. Give us the time and we'll take you out of the traffic and away from the levee. Let's find the place where the loons call out among the moonlit waves, where the wind sighs among the Norway pines. Pull up a dock chair, have a sip of your coffee, and get a line in the water. This is Cabin Country. Now here's Bjorn Lloydsted, and I'm Fudd Klugman with another woodland escape.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cabin Country. We're glad to have you back. As always, I am Bjorn Lloydsted.
And I'm Fudd Klugman.
And Fudd, we're both pretty excited tonight because, you know, we both spent a lot of years listening to bird call CDs and looking through books of pictures of wild flowers, wild plants, wild animals. The irony there is they're almost always written by the one, the only Stan Tequila.
That's right.
Sort of a radio personality, an author in the sense of books and articles and newspapers and magazines. We hear him on the radio. He's been a source for all things Cabin Country for so long. Very much kind of an icon in Cabin Country itself. And lo and behold, we were lucky enough to get him on the show.
I couldn't believe it. I'd always thought, well, someday when we get a little better known here in Cabin Country,
right,
make a name for ourselves, we can reach
Bjorn
out.
And Fudd.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Let's reach out to Stan Tequila now that we're something.
Seemed like it might be years
We've
away.
Got two dozen listeners now. Let's give it a try.
Absolutely.
But no, I just found him online and sent him an email, and I couldn't believe it. The first thing in the next morning, he said, yes, I'd be honored, and gave him a phone call, and inside of 3 days, we're meeting him at his place.
The Eden Prairie Outdoor Nature Center, where we got to sit down and talk with the man himself, and we got plenty of great information that looks like it could well turn into two full episodes of Cabin Country. So if you love all things Stan, you're in luck. The next two episodes will be Stan Tequila in his element. So what do you think? Should we quit talking? And
yeah, I suppose people are saying, well, quit gabbing, then let's get him on.
We want to hear Stan.
Let's get him on.
Stick a sock in it, Bjorn. All right. So without further ado, Mr. Stan Tequila.
How many jobs do you actually do, Stan? You're a man of many talents, so tell us about all the hats that you wear.
How many jobs? Last time I checked, it's 7 to 8 different kind of what I call revenue streams. It's things I have to do to bring in money. Uh-huh. And so I do a whole variety of things. So I do about 8 different things to make one living, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not easy.
The authorship and
yep,
recordings.
So number one, it would be writing books. So I've been writing books for over 30 years, and I've come out with over 200 books in that 30 plus years. And so that continues to be my main kind of thing that I do.
Right.
My main income and what I push at the hardest.
Right.
And then from there, it kind of all cascades downhill from there. So
a lot of media spots and,
yes,
and all kinds of things. Would you say that, Stan, the being a writer is sort of your chief love? It's where your heart's at? No?
No, I'm a horrible writer, and okay. I don't enjoy it. I know how some people are always like, oh, yeah, I just love the process of
the
writing.
Muse, yes.
And I just, I'm in there gagging for every moment that I'm typing away. You know. But a funny thing, though, is that in high school, you know, which was like almost a million years ago, I learned to type.
Right.
And I learned to type because that's where all the girls were at.
Okay, right? Sure.
Yeah, and then what I did was, I don't know how many years later after that, when my career started really going with this book writing and writing a newspaper column, I thought, I better, because I was hunting, pecking with one finger, you know, mm-hmm. and I thought, I better, you know, whip out those skills. So I did, and amazingly, it came right back to me.
Sure.
And so when I type now, I don't look at my keyboard. I'm looking at the screen, and I'm just going away. And
Having
I
can, at it.
Man, do I go fast on the keyboard.
Well, that's cool.
I mean, I can't spell.
Right,
you know, so thank God for spell check. You know, and my editor's constantly telling me I'm an idiot because I don't know, you know, that I change my tenses all the time, you know, present tense to past tense all the time. And
it's a great American pastime.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
come on, that's what we do. I mean, for Pete's sake.
But other than that, yeah, so I write a lot. I write a syndicated newspaper column. So that's 750 words every 2 weeks. So I always like, I always say it's like having a term paper due every 2 weeks.
Sure.
Which is not fun. And and that goes out across about 9 states. Mm-hmm. I have about 750,000 readers every 2 weeks.
Okay, so you're being heard. That's great.
So I get out there.
Right. Yep.
And I just do so many different things. Like I do audio recordings of birds and animal sounds, and I work with a company out of New York City who puts out, like, we just put out a you know, because of the COVID thing, it's all, you know, everybody's stressed out.
Yeah,
we put out a meditation CD, just beautiful sounds.
Right,
people can listen to it, meditate, relax, and all that stuff.
Nature sounds.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, I mean, I can't think of a better meditative kind of thing to have in the background.
It's the best thing.
The sounds of the great outdoors.
Then I do, so there's so many things. I take pictures, so I'm a wildlife photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And wildlife photography has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. It used to be a pretty big part of my income.
Right.
You know, it was a big part. I could sell a lot of images, you know, magazines, books, and all that stuff. And then digital hit in 2001, 2002,
right.
And everybody became a photographer, because back when you had film, you had to know what you were doing.
Right.
And now you don't. Now you can just take these cameras are so good these days. You can just point it at something, push the button, and you got amazing images.
Immediately brings it into focus for you.
It's the best autofocus, positive. Great. Yeah. You know, it does everything. Auto ISO, it does, you know, does it all. And, and then you've got these great images. So now people were just giving away their pictures. So the market fell out selling pictures. So I switched over a number of years ago to video. So now I do a lot of high-end video, all 4K video. And so I live my life in 10 to 30-second clips. So, yeah.
I love that idea. I really do. So would you say that kind of being out in the wild with your cameras, your microphones, that's perhaps nearest and dearest to your heart?
That's by far my favorite.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so in order to adapt and survive, I used to revel in the fact of being out there myself, maybe me, my partner, that's it. And but in order to survive in this economy and what's going on, I now lead photo tours.
Right.
So I lead lots of photo tours all over the country. I have I take people to photograph common loons. So the whole month of June, I'm out doing photo tours with common loons, western grebes, and American black bears. So it's a fun kind of thing. And then I work with a company out of Europe, and they send me groups of Europeans, and I lead photo tours for them to Florida, to Yellowstone, and to here, to Minnesota, where I do black bears and all that stuff with it, too.
The mighty loon.
Common loon. This magnificent bird of our northern lakes has 4 distinct calls. The yodel is the most common and haunting of the calls. It's a territorial call given by the males. The tremolo is 5 to 10 repeating notes, often given in flight. It is said to be the laughing call of the loon. The wail sounds somewhat like a wolf howling and is often heard echoing across the lake late during the day or at night. Last is the hoot. This soft call note is given to keep in contact with family members.
So you're all over the country. I would imagine. I mean, I know we can find your books all across the country. I've seen your books in Wyoming, in Montana, in California. You know, that's wonderful.
Right.
But you're actually out there leading tours through.
Yeah.
So that's outstanding.
Yeah. So I get 6 to 8 people, and I take them around. Like in right before the COVID thing hit, I ran. I was in Florida, and we did. We do 8 days of going from point to point to point, photographing all sorts of birds. It's mainly birds.
Birding,
that's what people are into. Okay. People are into birds. They're into, you know, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. Was it specifically Everglades or all across the Panhandle?
I'm
or?
Not a huge fan of Everglades, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the diversity that I kind of like.
And all seabirds, I would guess, or marsh birds.
It's very limited access, too.
Yeah.
So, but there's about 7-8 places where I go that are really, really, really good, and they have a variety of things.
Right.
So Florida's a big spot for me. Arizona's another big spot for me. So I spend a lot of time traveling. I used to.
Yeah. I was going to say, and I'll ask this question and then turn it over. I live for a summer in Costa Rica, and I'm thinking, gosh, as a birder, have you ever spent any time?
Oh, I've been to Costa Rica.
Gracious.
It's fantastic. Yeah. The birds out there are amazing. And what's really what Costa Rica is really well known for is the hummingbirds.
Yep.
You know? So here in the East, you know, we have one species of hummingbird.
Yeah, the ruby-throated.
The ruby-throated, right. And whoop-de-doo, right?
Well, when we see them here, we're like, hey!
It's incredible. I love it, too, when the Europeans come here and they see their first hummingbird.
Sure.
Their eyes fall out of their heads.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, my gosh, what is that?
Yeah.
You know? And then, but if you go to places like Arizona, you can get upwards of 15 species.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to Costa Rica, you can get hundreds of species. And in fact, on one mountainside, depending on what elevations you're at, you can get upwards of 20 different species in the different elevations up the mountainside. So,
right. Yeah. You know. They used to come to our window boxes. And I mean, we were seeing, hey, it's a purple.
Whatever.
It's a we got a book, you know, just trying to keep track. And somebody keep score. This is ridiculous.
Exactly.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, there's so many of them. Yeah, birds in general are one of my kind of big things. You know, I'm a naturalist, so I'm interested in all of it. Plants.
Okay.
The animals, you know, the birds, the insects, the rocks, the stars, the weather.
It's all good.
The whole thing. Right. It's all good. I like to call it the big picture of things, and that's what I kind of go for. I like that.
I will admit I was guilty of reading a lot of Yul Gibbons.
Oh, yeah.
As a younger man, but still today. And,
And
so part of it for me is the urban foraging and what can I eat and not have to take syrup of Ipecac?
You know,
where am I good and where am I not? But birds, wildlife, to be able to see wildlife.
Yeah.
Incredible. You know, city kids. So
I spend a time going to, and I go seek out those animals.
Sure.
You know, you'd mentioned about seeing black bears earlier off the air. We kind of talked about black bears. And I take people right to black bears so you can see them up close. And that is just always a mind opening, like, holy mackerel, look
at
that.
You're not going to die.
Yeah, because generally they're not interested in eating you. They want food.
Right.
You know, they don't, you know, people are not a really good food source. I mean, it's not that you can't get attacked by black bears. You can.
Right.
It's just that, you know, if you approach it right, if you do it right, you're going to be safe.
Well, and there's a Lynn, I forget his last name.
Lynn Rogers.
Yeah, and how he goes, I actually spent a night in a black bear den. Everybody thinks it would stink. It was actually one of the cleanest places I've ever been. And, I spent a lot of summers in Ely in the North American Black Bear Center. And it's just, so many people are, you really have nothing to worry about. They're just, they're just looking for food.
Backyard birds is sort of a big, you know, that's what most people can sort of identify because, well, I have a bird feeder in my backyard. And I just recently watched a YouTube video where you're talking about uncommon facts about common birds.
Yeah.
And so I'm just fascinated by some of those birds we all kind of know, but don't know a lot about. And of course, we know which ones we think are bad birds.
Yeah.
But
so getting back to, you know, you were asking before about how, you know, many different revenue streams and how many different ways I make a living.
Right.
One of the ways, as you just mentioned, is I give presentations. I give talks to groups. And I do that all over the country, and I do it for groups of, you know, small groups to gigantic groups. And whoever will pay me to come and talk, I'm there, you know. And so talking to people is kind of a big thing I do. And one of my most popular talks is the uncommon facts about common birds. And I try to point out people's foibles, people's kind of double standards that they have. They don't think they have them, but they've got them.
Yeah.
And it even spills over into the natural world. So nature isn't there to benefit you or me or anybody else.
Right.
It's there because it evolved to this point. It has survived. It has clawed. It has done everything it can to cling to life for millions of years. And most of our birds, our modern birds that we have around to this day, have been around for millions of years. Anywhere from 2 to, say, upwards of 9 million years, these birds have been around. And so what you're seeing is a result of lots of evolution. And those birds are out there just doing their thing. They don't have a a role, you know, if you will.
Right.
Nature is always seeking a balance. Nature is always trying to look. It comes down to this, and this is I'm famous for saying this. It all comes down to one of two things in nature. It's either how to find food or how to reproduce. Mm-hmm. So it's sex and food.
Yep.
You know, I mean,
yep.
These are topics I can understand. You know, I can get
fairly
my head
popular with all
yeah,
species.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And that's what it's about there. It's about finding enough food to keep enough health to be able to reproduce. And here we are, I don't know when we're going to air this, but this is the end of kind of spring, beginning of summer.
Right.
And everything when you go outside, it's all reproduction. There's baby squirrels, there's baby bunnies, there's baby birds, there's fish spawning, there's everything that's going on right now, and it's all about reproduction. It's all about the reproducting of the genes to pass them along to, you know, continue the species. That's what it's about. So when we as people, and we do this all the time, when we start saying, you know, what good is it, you know, which is a fabulous question all the time. What good is it? One time I walked into a little gas station in South Dakota, kind of in the middle of nowhere. I just walked in the door, and first thing I was greeted with was a beat up old gas station. You know, it's been there for like 100 years type of thing. And I walked in, there's this little cage with a prairie dog in it.
Okay.
And I looked and I went, ah, a little black-tailed prairie dog. And there was this old timer sitting next to it in a chair. And he goes, yep, for the life of me, I can't figure out what good these things are. I thought to myself, am I in candid camera here? You know, and for those of you who are not old enough to know what candid camera is, you know,
Alan Funk.
Yeah,
there you bet.
So it's like I thought, am I being punked here? What's going on? You asked me that, and so I just went into went at this guy. I'm really? First of all, let me ask you, what good are you?
Yeah.
You know, and then
yeah.
Second of all, what good? You know, what does it do? Is that the question? Do you want to know what it does? I'll tell you what it does. And I went on and explained the benefits of them and how intelligent they are.
Sure.
And all the different things and all the other animals that depend upon, you know, prairie dogs in which to live, including burrowing owls. Who doesn't love a burrowing owl?
Right.
You know, but, you know, snakes take advantage of it. There's so many things that take advantage of prairie dog stuff. But so, again, you just have to change the way you think slightly in order to be able to answer those questions yourself, really.
Right. I can just picture that guy saying, you know how many horses have broken their legs stepping in these prairie dogs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, answer, who cares?
Yeah, evolutionarily.
You know, why are you riding your horse in the prairie dog town? You know,
well, evolutionarily speaking, if those horses were breaking their legs, they should die.
Yeah.
You know? They're not smart enough to miss it. Then,
right.
You know? I mean, that's, you know, and so there's a lot of that out there.
Right.
You know, and we as people, of course, we change our habitats, we change our environments so much, and then we sit back and go, well, that's dumb. You know, and I always like to say, you know, if people are criticizing nature, saying it's dumb or something like that, I say, well, all right, strip down, get out in the woods, survive, get back to me, okay? Get back to me, tell me how it went.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, because those animals are out there surviving day in, day out, no problems. You know,
and freezing to death under a tree looking for water. Right.
Exactly.
Well, maybe that's a great segue for this question. I thought, I'm just curious. I want to know, and you're the man to ask. You know, the crows, the ravens. I love ravens. Red-headed, red-winged blackbirds, the yellow-headed blackbirds. Love them all.
Yeah.
Side story, we have a little cat we throw out in the backyard in a cage just to give this. My wife thinks the cat needs outdoors.
Sure, a little outdoor stimulation.
Why not?
Yeah.
I come outside yesterday. The cat's cowering in fear as two brown-headed cowbirds are staring it down. She wouldn't get off of, oh my God. I was like, and they wouldn't. I walked up to them and looked at them and kind of turned my head, and they just sat there staring at me.
Yeah.
The male roughed up his feathers.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I guess that's my time to leave.
Yeah.
What, in your opinion, Stan, is the bird around the Twin Cities or around the suburbs or even out in the country, any you know, biome that's the most misunderstood bird by Minnesotans in general, or upper Midwesterners, American, whatever, the human race, the bird that takes the most heat and yet is probably the most unknowingly beneficial, you know?
Well, there's a lot of them, actually, on that list. Crows, of course, are one of the top,
right?
Because I have this theory. It goes like this. The smarter the bird or the smarter the animal, the more people hate it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I don't, I'm not sure if they're just feeling threatened or what it is about them, but, you know, they are, without a doubt, the smartest birds we have here in North America.
Right.
So that's, crows are a big one that have kind of a bad PR.
Bad rap.
Yeah, bad rap. Brown-headed cowbirds. So the brown-headed cowbirds are a parasitic bird. And, you know, I mean, you don't even need to know what it means. you just hear the word, you know, it's a parasite, and you know it's bad. You know? And it simply means that the female doesn't build her own nest. She doesn't incubate her own young. What she does, she goes out and finds the nests of other birds and lays her eggs in these other birds' nests and lets them raise it.
Right.
Now, let's set aside for a moment that I think that this is ingenious because, you know, I mean, if you've ever raised children, you know what I mean. It's like, you know, and then when they become adults, they come back to you. I mean, how do you beat that? This is great. So, and so, but people don't like it because it messes with their sense of fair play. They think it's not fair. Yeah. And I try to remind people that these are native birds who have been here for millions of years. And by the way, we can throw around that word millions of years, right?
A long time. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Means nothing to anybody because, I mean, I have a hard enough time remembering last week. You know, I mean, a million years ago is like, holy criminy, it's just really something. Yeah. So to me, it's like they've been here, they've done just fine right alongside all the other species of birds, and they haven't won, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other birds, double-crested cormorants. Mm-hmm. These are those big black birds that actually the federal government now is shooting them because people think that they're eating our fish. I mean, how dare they eat our fish?
Right.
Right.
Especially all those squeaky clean ones coming out of the Mississippi up at the Ford plant.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, put that back. I want to eat that later. Grow a third eye. Right.
I actually had somebody call me, left me a voicemail the other day. I live on a lake, and they said, did you see the flock of cormorants that came in? There must have been 2,000 of them. And, of course, I saw them. There was about 250. And he says, it's funny. I was out that morning, and I was fishing, and I caught all sorts of fish. He says, but then those cormorants came in, and then that night I went out to fish, and I didn't catch a single fish. Do you think that they caught every fish?
Everyone in the lake.
And I was like,
gone.
Wow.
Unbelievable species.
Yes. So, and they say, well, we want to get rid of those cormorants because they eat our fish. And I'm like, great, great idea. So, number one on our list will be cormorants. Second, loons, because they eat our fish.
Yep.
Bald eagles, they should go because they eat our fish.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, and hopefully they're seeing the absurdity in all this because that's what it is. It's absurd to think that, you know. These, I mean, if that were the case, if the cormorants could land on a lake and eat every fish in there, guess what? They would have ate every fish about, I don't know, 4 million years ago.
Right.
You know?
Right. We'd be wondering what fish were.
Yeah, exactly. We wouldn't even know what a fish is. So,
no.
Yeah. You know, I think blue jays get bad raps all the time, too. But, you know, I think they're fabulous birds. And red-winged blackbirds, of course. There's so many that just get really starlings, European starlings.
That's
people hate European starlings.
Yep.
I think they're amazing. They're incredible mimics. So these birds, they can mimic just about anything they hear when they're growing up. So whatever it is they're around when they're young, they'll repeat that as they're younger. So if a starling grows up next to a bald eagle nest, they hear bald eagles, they'll make a bald eagle sound when they're grown up. You know, all sorts of different things like that. They're really fun. When they go into breeding condition, they change the color of their bill. They go from a gray bill in non-breeding season to a yellow bill in the breeding season. That'd be like you and me changing our hair color, you know.
Naturally.
When it came time to breed, you know.
Right,
it's like,
right.
I don't know. So there's so many kind of misunderstood. Here's the problem. We as people, we do the same thing. We do the same problem over and over again. We think that whatever it is that we see, whatever it is that we smell, whatever it is that we taste, whatever we hear, and worst off, whatever it is we feel, is what they do. That their experience, their interface with the world, is the same interface that we have with the world, and you couldn't be more wrong. Right. You're just absolutely dead wrong on so many levels when you compare yourself to a bird, for example. I mean, all right, if you want to compare yourself to, say, a chimp, we're getting a little closer.
Right, okay? Right. We're in the ballpark.
You're in the ballpark, but when you compare yourself to a bird, there's no comparison.
Right.
There's just no comparison. The only similarities are they have two legs and we have two legs, and that's about it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
Well, it's time for a short break, but when we come back, you'll hear me ask Stan a fairly ridiculous question about animals and old age. So don't go away.
Having a hard time finding shade around your place? Finding it difficult to grow shelter belt trees in your lot's questionable soil? Well, don't look now, but Cabin Country Natives has the tree for you. Populus deltoides varietal occidentalis, the mighty, mighty cottonwood. And now with a few words about the cottonwood, our good friend, good old Lloyd.
The cottonwood is a member of the poplar family and will thrill you with its adaptability to various soils and its love for full sunlight. The perfect tree to plant when you're looking for a quick-growing shade provider. The cottonwood loves water and being near water sources, but will grow regardless of conditions and rapidly at that. You won't be waiting long for your new cottonwood to shoot up like a weed. But wait, there's more. As members of the poplar family, cottonwoods tend to create their own groves through successful reproduction. You'll get as many cottonwoods as you'd like by planting one. The cottonwood grows quickly and creates a massive tree that can rise from 50 to 80 feet tall. Talk about shade. And if you're an aspen or a poplar fan, you'll recognize those lance-shaped leaves that seem to tremble in the breeze. Maybe not as romantically as the quaking aspen, but something very similar and in huge quantities. And that abundant foliage will blaze like gold in the autumn. The twigs of cottonwood are a source of wonderment with the heartwood shaped in a star pattern. Wow! And if the shade isn't enough to quell summer's heat, get ready for more. At the height of the summer's dog days, your cottonwood will make you think it's a warm winter by casting off its own snow. That's right. Cottonwood seeds are released amidst clouds of floating cotton. If your tree is large enough, you'll think it's time to put up the holiday lights. What are you waiting for? Don't delay. Get to Cabin Country Natives and get your cottonwood today.
We're sorry, but only female cottonwood trees will produce the cotton that inspired this tree's name. Cabin Country Natives also cannot be held responsible for the resinous and sticky bud cones that drop like a gummy rain under the tree in the spring. Cottonwood seedlings will need to be dealt with immediately if you do not desire your own cottonwood forest. Do not plant cottonwood near power lines.
Back to Bjorn and Fudd with special guest Stan Tequila in Cabin Country. I've always been intrigued by this mystery of life in nature. Mm-hmm. When animals die, I mean, the ones that aren't, well, killed by cars on the highway or or preyed upon, how, in your understanding, how do most animals die in the woods without humans seeing them? Or are they just all become, it's hard for me to think, does an old robin just sit and then one day it just dies and falls off the branch? How much can you tell us?
Man, you guys are weird.
We're trying to cover every perspective.
Yes. So. We've got some odd listeners, that's it. That's the whole story.
Well, rarely do animals live to old age in the wild. That's just right. How the wild is. It's very demanding to be out there. It's very demanding to be. Look, think about it. You got to catch or find your food every day, regardless. Yep. You can't take weekends off. I mean, you're every day. You got to find your food. You got to stay away from predators. Something that's bigger than you, meaner than you, badder than you. And you got to kind of keep that going all the time. So rarely do they make it. So, for example, animals in the wild. Average lifespan of a hummingbird in the wild, 4 years. They usually meet their demise way before they become old.
Right.
And there's very few. There's a few mammals that get to be old, but mostly like old bison and things like that, or some old bears, and there's a few that have just gotten lucky and made it through.
Right.
And a small percentage is going to do that. It's going to make it through to that, end point. But the vast majority of them don't make it, and they meet their end in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about nature. Everything that dies is recycled back into nature. People are what's not efficient. Nature is very efficient, so nothing goes to waste. Something dies. I mean, look, think of it this way. You want how deep and intricate this goes. In the late winter or midwinter, when a deer's antler falls off its head, lands in the ground, does it just sit there forever and ever and ever. No, it's actually consumed by small rodents.
Right.
And that's why we would be knee-deep in antlers all over the place if that were the case. And that's just not the case. They're all chewed up. Here at the Nature Center, what we did one time is we took a nice big deer antler that we I drilled a hole through it. I fished a metal cable through it, and we locked it to the bird feeder on the ground over there, put a date on it, and just let it sit there. And magically, that thing got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, down to it was a little nubbin after about a year and a half.
Right.
It was totally gone.
Right.
Just to show, and we're not seeing it. I mean, these are mice and shrews and voles coming out at nighttime who are chewing on it, chipmunks, rabbits, whatever, and they're chewing on this thing, and it's gone. And you think about that. That's all calcium. It's 100% bone, basically, and gone. Same thing. So I spent a lot of time in very wild places like Yellowstone where you have wolves, top predators, who are out hunting. They happen to get a kill. They make a kill. Within, I would say, at least 10 minutes of that kill, the first raven is there.
Right.
And then within an hour, there are ravens galore, magpies, golden eagles, bald eagles, and then coyotes come in, foxes come in, bears come in, everything comes in. And that kill, within 48 hours, is completely and utterly gone.
Right.
Bones are gone. Fur is mostly taken away for nesting material and things like that. And it is history. That is an ecosystem that's intact and working and functioning correctly.
Right.
So in places like your backyard, the ecosystem is not functioning correctly. And so, or even your backwoods, you know, something dies there, it takes a little bit longer. But if all the predators were there, if all the components of the nature was there, it'd be cleaned up and gone within 48 hours.
Right.
So.
Right.
Continuing on the death theme here, I don't know what's fascinating about it, but Bjorn and I were talking last night, and we were talking about the characteristic of crows. Like if a crow was done, in fact, Bjorn, why don't you take over what you had observed?
I'm a avowed public television geek, and nature in particular, NOVA.
Of course.
And I remember watching, I believe it was a NOVA, and they were just talking about the intelligence of crows. And doing a piece on a specific researcher and his team was going through Central Park wearing specific masks and how the crows could identify each of these different masks as an entity.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, at one point, a member of the murder was hit by a taxi and died. And the entire group, it was almost like a funeral.
Yeah.
They sat on power lines and ledges around where that crow had passed for about 24 hours and then almost as like on a signal it was time to move on, but they saw the death of a member of that murder of crows, and they kind of sat court, you know, sat vigil watching that. I don't know, maybe so, you've got more to say about that.
So the mask thing was at the University of New York at Ithaca, and what they did was they took a Richard Nixon mask, a rubberized mask,
and well, maybe that was it.
And they they terrorized these young crows, and then the crows remembered that face, and so then years later they could walk across the campus with that mask on, and those crows would spot that face and kind of go at it.
Yeah,
what I thought was amazing about it is that they taught their young about it, so the young who had never seen it before then would also help mob that, you know, that mask, if you will. So, which really shows that these birds have the ability to communicate, and in a way in which it's able to communicate information that is kind of ephemeral, or I shouldn't say ephemeral, kind of out there.
It's it seems beyond the can of the average.
You got to think about it. Right? Yeah, exactly. I'm doing a lot of research right now on bird brains, and which sounds funny. That's why I say
the brains. I've been called a bird brain many times.
It's actually a fairly good thing to have because when
take that as a compliment.
When you take a look at the size of the brain of a bird compared to its body, it's actually fairly small, but yet they do remarkable things with it too. I mean, they've got nice studies showing things like Clark's nutcrackers, which is a species of bird out in the West. It's related to the jays and the crows, who can plant 700 different seeds in the ground and remember where every single one of them is.
Oh wow!
I would plant them in the ground, and an hour later I'd be going, now where did I?
Where are my keys?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You know? So it's truly amazing what they can can and can't do.
Yeah.
It truly is. So there's a lot of things about crows. Most of these studies that they're doing with crows, they do a lot with American crows, mm-hmm. But a lot of them are with the New Caledonia crows. New Caledonia is a island kind of the way, mm-hmm. I don't even... South Pacific.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds.
Yeah. Anyhow, and they're doing a lot of studies on the crows there. For some reason, those crows are exceptionally smart, and they're trying to figure out why. Part of it is that they have no predators of mm-hmm. themselves, and mm-hmm. They're kind of like the king of the roost, and they've got some pretty intelligent things that they do. So kind of neat.
Well, crows are by nature tool users too, correct?
Right. Right. Yeah. So of course, 35-40 years ago, we used to use the fact that. People use tools as a demarcation between humans and the animal kingdom.
Right.
We actually thought, I mean, how presumptive, right?
Yeah.
That we were different because we used tools.
Than.
And, of course, do you guys know who the first person to show us animals using tools was? Do you remember who this was? It was a woman.
Jane Goodall.
Jane Goodall with her chimps, yeah. And then after that, it was like the building blocks started falling, and we found all sorts of animals using tools.
Look at that sea otter.
Also, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Sea otters with a rock. You know.
He thinks he's eating a rock. Yeah. No, he's using a rock to open the clam.
Exactly. Oh. And so you've got all sorts of animals, all sorts of birds, all sorts of creatures using tools, and crows are no exception. They also use tools, too. And that, so this is a classic case of humans when we don't know. We presume certain things, and we presume usually wrong.
Yep.
And so we always have to be kind of careful about those types of
presumptions
that we come up with all the time, especially when it compares us to the natural world. So I firmly believe that we're part of the natural world. I don't believe we're apart from it. We're definitely part of it.
Well, we've sure lost the ability to survive in it without our human invented.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. You know, creature comforts. So
I think it's. Well, I've heard that, humans would last maybe a year without nature and the animal world. And animals, of course, would flourish and survive much.
Oh, yeah. They don't need us. We need them. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny that this is becoming the crow and death episode. But
yes. What is up with that?
We'll move on.
Cite Raven by
Paul. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There we go. No, we'll move on from that. But I had the experience of seeing, a dying crow in my backyard, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what to do with it. And in fact, being a photographer myself, I thought, well, look how close I can get to this, and I'm going to videotape this process. But I felt so bad, and most of us this armchair naturalist, we don't know what to do. And you being a bird rehab person, like starlings and crows and even flying squirrels and mm-hmm. things.
Yeah.
Orville over there is watching us. What can you tell us about what we should and shouldn't do when we see an animal that is clearly suffering?
You left the crow alone to die in peace, correct?
I'm afraid I didn't leave the crow. I felt like I had the mistaken thought, well, I'm thinking it's mistaken, that I should put this out of its misery.
Mm.
And I feel like that wasn't the right thing I did. I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, this thing is clearly dying. I didn't know who to call. But what can you tell us about that? And maybe people are causing, like myself, more harm than good mm-hmm. if they encounter an injured animal.
Yeah. So injured animals are different, I think, from orphaned animals or perceived orphaned animals. Yesterday, for example, we were in the garden here at the Nature Center, and there was a baby bunny. It was this big, 3 inches, tiny little thing. I mean, it was just minuscule.
Brand new.
And the person I was with kind of shooed it out of the garden, and they said, "My, that was really a small rabbit." I said, "It's because it's a baby." And they said, "Oh," and then they felt bad. Maybe it's, but there's some general rules there with, if, and like with rabbits, if they're fully furred, their eyes are open, and they're running, they're on their own.
Right.
That's how nature works there. And a lot of birds will spend their first 1 to 3 days of out of the nest on the ground. And we oftentimes will think, oh, there's something wrong with it, and we've got to rescue it and things, when in fact, that's what it normally does. I have a colony of purple martins at my house. And guess what? My purple martin babies are on the ground right now. And I sit and watch them. Because that's what happens. They fly out of their nest, and they're on the ground for at least 1 to 3 days while the parents feed them. That's just natural. This is how it happens. And so if you didn't realize that, you might think, oh, there's something wrong here. So there's a lot of these types of things. And as a wildlife photographer myself, you kind of, there's this unwritten, well, it is kind of written, but it's an oath, if you will, of that you don't interfere with nature. That's the code.
Right.
The code is you don't want to interfere with nature, so you want to sit back and let it happen the way it wants to happen. Now, having said that, 3 weeks ago, I heard what I thought was some baby birds right outside the door here at the Nature Center, and I was looking for them, and I was like, where the heck are these things? I could hear them. They were clearly crying, and then they would stop, and then they would start crying again, just like a normal baby bird would, and I finally tracked it down to the point where I was like, oh my gosh, it's underneath the deck. What bird would be underneath the deck? None. No bird would be underneath the deck. So I took out my little flashlight, and I clicked on the flashlight, and I looked under the deck, and I was nose to nose with a mother mink.
I
was like, oh, jeez. You know, and so I was like, let's go. You know, let's get out of here because I didn't want to disturb her, you know. And so we backed off, you know, and just let her be. And the next day, came to work, and I could hear one baby crying, and that was it. And apparently she had taken all of her other babies and moved them. And that's the problem with a lot of animals. They can't count.
Right.
So, you know, so she had left one behind. And I spent the day looking for where the mom moved to and couldn't find her anywhere. Kind of made this baby comfortable, let it sit there waiting, hoping she would come back for it. Waited 24 hours, didn't come back for it. Clearly got to take action. And so at that point, took the baby and brought it to the wildlife rehab clinic in Roseville. Roseville, Minnesota has got the largest wild animal clinic in the United States. And
wow.
They take in more animals than anybody, and they do an amazing job. And so you can always, they don't send people out. They don't have rescue teams. They don't have any first responders. They don't have anything.
The Delta team is coming out.
They got nothing.
Baby mink.
You got to bring them in. So you got to get a box, put them in there, keep it dark, keep it quiet. Don't feed them. Don't, you know, whatever, and bring them on in. And that's the best thing to do. And they're open 7 days a week, and they're good friends of mine. They're wonderful people. Look, if you're ever looking for an organization to support, you think, I would really like to do something for nature. I would like to do something for wildlife.
Yeah.
These people are on the front lines every day taking in tens of thousands of baby birds, baby squirrels, rabbits, whatever, and taking care of them, raising them up, and then releasing them back into the wild. These guys are the closest things to saints that you can find on Earth. They do amazing jobs there. So,
what are they called?
This is the Wildlife Rehab Clinic in Roseville, Minnesota.
So right there in the first ring suburbs of the
Twin
Cities.
Dale Street. Yeah, right on Dale Street off of Highway 36.
Okay.
Like one block off. It's
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I have. It's amazing. I had no idea.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know. It's kind of like my nature center here. They just like people. Oh, I didn't know you were here. It's kind of like the wildlife rehab clinic. People didn't know they were there. But
ironically, I used to. You know, with the yard with my dying crow, I lived about 2 miles from this place.
And,
so it really hurts
that
my
one.
Heart.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah. I'm almost sorry that I had to share it, but it made us learn about this wildlife refuge place.
You know, I grew up in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, you know, second, third ring suburb, and still had elements that were kind of wild. Bald Eagle Lake, White Bear Lake. How many times I almost ran over, you know, whippoorwills that were bedded down in our lawn.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
You know, just sleeping.
Not anymore.
No. No. Well, thank God. You know, I mean, what in the world? There's a squirrel down.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know.
And there's a whippoorwill.
There was a whippoorwill. Yeah.
When was the last time you heard a whippoorwill here in Twin Cities, huh? You haven't.
I know. So maybe what's the story there? What's
so almost all of our ground nesting birds, which whippoorwills are ground nesting birds, are on the decline in huge numbers. So 80-90% decline in their population. So everything from meadowlarks to bobolinks, dick sissels, all these kind of ground nesting birds are nearly gone. And it's a lot of it has to do with the changing habitats, the amount of pesticides, herbicides that we use, the number of increase in mid-sized predators like skunks and raccoons, because there's no other predator to take care of them.
Right.
You know, we've wiped out our coyotes, we've wiped out our mountain lions, we've wiped out our wolves and all that stuff.
Sure.
And so you've got these other things. So nature is kind of out of balance once again.
Right.
So... But whippoorwills are some of those species. You just don't see them anymore.
And I didn't realize there were so many sort of, you know, varietals. You know, my former, I mean, when he was still around, you know, my dad was a science teacher by trade and said, well, was it a whippoorwill or was it a Chuck Wills widow or was it a nightjar? Or when I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't even know what, you know.
Well, fortunately for us, we only have the one species here, but which is the whippoorwill.
And gone.
We do have common nighthawks, which look very similar to them. The common nighthawks are an interesting bird who comes out at night, hence its name, nighthawk.
Right.
During the kind of the mid 1900s or so, when we started building buildings with flat top roofs, this was a real common thing in the 50s and 60s and 70s, these flat top roofs. We put down a rubberized membrane and then put rock all over it, and this was your roof. Who came up with this idea? Is this a
whippoorwill
recipe for disaster?
And nighthawk breeders.
Well, yeah, apparently, because that was a heyday for those birds who bred on the ground, basically, and they took over these rooftops, and they did really well. But then starting in the 80s and 90s, everybody got rid of these roofs because they always leaked.
Yep.
And they went to other roofing styles, which got rid of the rocks and the flat tops and all like that, and our numbers of common nighthawks dropped like a rock.
Yep.
And so we hardly ever see them anymore.
Sure.
And they just not around at all. You find them in more kind of rural areas now, but that's about it. They're really an interesting bird, too. They're in the nightjar family.
Do they have that short beak and almost the whiskers?
Yeah, those are called bristles. And it's funny because they look like whiskers. They look like hair, actually. Yeah. But you remember, these are not mammals. These are birds, and so they are modified feather. Yeah, and they use that as a sensory, just like whiskers.
Yeah.
And they catch bugs at night.
Right.
And they fly around in the evening, right at sunset, and they catch all these bugs, and that's how they make a living.
Yeah. It's funny when I think about this. I was the surly teenager mowing my dad's yard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would put me in about the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And so,
when they were around.
When they were around.
Yeah.
Right. And it was a good-sized bird, too. I didn't realize
big.
They were as large as they were.
So there's a lot of those things like that. And as kids, you probably remember tiger salamanders in your window wells.
Yeah.
You know, everybody had them
catching
in their window wells.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. When was the last time you seen a tiger salamander? You know, gone. And these are key indicator species. In particular, salamanders, which is a type of amphibian, is a very unusual animal in that it gets most of its moisture through its skin.
Mm-hmm.
It also breathes a lot through its skin. And so, therefore, the skin is very porous, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it takes in everything in the environment. So if you're putting down those heavy chemicals to make your lawn nice and green, then, you know, you're going to be affecting those animals.
Right.
And they are the first ones to go, are the salamanders and the frogs and the toads. And those are all the first things that go that kind of get wiped out of an area.
Or amphibians.
When you move into it, So there's lots to be said about that.
I was actually thinking about that the other day, Stan. I was like, my neighbors used to catch, they'd run around. Who could catch the most salamanders?
In one night. Yeah.
And I haven't seen one of those in
they're gone.
Probably 4 decades.
They're gone. They're,
sad.
It was something that kids could enjoy and had some fun
with. Well, they'd put them back, you know, or they'd go down to the pond by the elementary school and catch painted turtles.
Mm-hmm.
They're still around, but more adaptable.
Yeah.
But boy, the salamanders are just gone. The frogs, you know, you don't hear as many spring peepers anymore when you're out.
Chorus frogs,
right?
All that. Yeah, they're all they're all in the downswing.
Right.
What about red-headed woodpeckers? They were
great question.
Because I saw that in the video, and they make their own nests in trees, hollowed out nests. And it was a mystery as to why their numbers were declining. So how is that looking now?
So in 1850, John James Audubon, you may have heard this guy, he said that the red-headed woodpecker was the most numerous woodpecker in North America. He says it was semi-domesticated. He said it was a pest. He says it was a camp robber. It would come in and steal things out of camp and things like that. And so it was a very, very common bird. And we started tracking the numbers of birds in the year 1900. Have you guys heard of the CBC, the Christmas Bird Count?
I honestly have not. No.
Oh, interesting. Good.
Yeah.
So late 1800s, early 1900s, the Victorian times, it was holiday tradition to go out at Christmas time with your family and a shotgun and shoot little birds. Yeah, so now I can't think of a more festive way to celebrate
the holidays.
Nothing
like
says holidays
the
like
heads up,
by blasting innocent little birds, you know? And
happy holidays.
Yeah, Audubon Society, which was just starting then, said, hey, look, instead of going out at the holidays and shooting birds, let's go out and count them. not how many species you saw, but exactly how many chickadees you saw,
right.
how many cardinals you saw, how many whatever it was.
Right.
And they started a database in the year 1900. That still goes on to this day. In fact, I do, it occurs all over the world, by the
okay.
way,
okay.
this
yeah.
Christmas bird count. And there are, in your neighborhood, in your town, your whatever, there is a Christmas bird count going on right around Christmas. There's a group of volunteers. I urge you to look them up, get involved. It's such a fun way to get out, learn, meet other people,
yep.
and go out and do the most interesting things. My section is in Richfield, Bloomington
sure.
area,
yep.
and I take care of the international airport and kind of would be eastern Richfield.
Correct.
And so I get to go, the airport security takes me into the inner perimeter of the airport, and
yeah.
I drive around and we look for snowy owls
okay.
for the Christmas bird count. So
yeah.
anyhow, it's a fun way to get out there, and you can be... Your area can be small or can be large. And long story short, look up the Christmas bird count. So we got all this data, right, from the year 1900 till now.
Yeah.
When you look at red-headed woodpecker, see, this is a long way of getting back to your question, right?
No, it's
When you look at the red-headed woodpecker from the year 1900 to the year 1950 or 1960, there's really no change in the red-headed population at all. From the year 1960 to the year 2010, there's an 86% decline. 86.
Wow.
That's nearly all of
precipitous
them.
Precipitous drop-off.
Huge
yeah.
drop-off. And so we're down to the last dregs of red-headed woodpeckers. If you grew up here in Minnesota and you were anywhere near the country, you had red-headed woodpeckers as a kid, you don't have them now. They're just not around at all. And so the question is, why? You know,
mm-hmm.
and the answer is they've been studying it. We really don't know why. It's probably because they're a habitat specialist, and the habitat that they kind of prefer is an oak savanna.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. What's an oak savanna, right? I mean, we all have heard of prairie.
Newell
We've all
Park.
Heard of wetlands. We've all heard of, you know, deciduous conifer forest like that.
Right.
But we haven't heard of, so, I mean, in Minnesota, we're down to less than 1% of our prairies. Right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And an oak savanna is a prairie with oak trees on it, so it's even more rare than
right.
our 1% of our prairie left. So
right.
it's very, very small areas that are just no longer around, and so that's probably it. We don't know. It may mm-hmm. be the use of pesticides killing, because these guys are primary hunters of insects.
Right.
I once wrote an article called "When Is a Woodpecker Not a Woodpecker?" And it's when it's a redhead, because they act more like hawks than woodpeckers. They sit on a branch, they watch for a bug to fly by, they fly out and they snap it right out of midair and they fly back like a flycatcher.
Right.
You know, so
right.
they're really an unusual species of bird.
Right.
And we've seen them decline like crazy, and they're just not around anymore.
So if you were feet put to the fire, Stan, where in Minnesota at this point would you find an oak savanna? You say that's almost all gone. Is yeah. there a stand of it left?
Yeah, there's
anywhere?
one stand. It's owned by the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
It's just north of the Twin Cities in Blaine.
Okay.
It's the Cedar Creek Natural Area.
Sure.
It's private, or they own it, so you have to have permission to go in there. But
right.
they have an oak savanna, and they have a nice, solid population of red-headed woodpecker, but
right.
that's about it.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I live in St. Paul, and the tiny little park kind of
mm-hmm.
right off of Energy Park Drive called Newell Park, and they say mm-hmm. this is the last remaining piece of the great woods, the great you know what they talked about, the Laura Ingalls Wilder
yeah,
book,
the big woods,
you know, my life in the big woods, or
yeah.
my little cabin
right.
in the big woods,
right,
that's it,
right,
you know, there's about 12 picnic tables and a really nice swing set and there's all these oak trees,
yeah.
everything else been cut down,
yeah, so that was the big woods
yeah.
is a unique habitat that was found only in Minnesota and Wisconsin,
right,
and it was a it's a deciduous forest,
yeah.
Composed mainly of oaks and mm-hmm. Elms, basswoods, and things like that. And these big woods was a unique kind of a blend of trees that is very rare now.
Yeah.
There's a nice one out in Plymouth, kind of Medina
okay.
area. It's
yeah.
called Wolfsfeld Woods.
Okay.
It's a nice example of one. It's maybe 30, 40 acres or something like that. It's not real mm-hmm. big, but it's still a stand. Oh, a Nurstrand.
Nurstrand
State
Woods,
Park,
yeah,
down in which is south of Northfield.
Oh yes, it's my in-laws' country.
Yeah,
so.
that's a really good. If you want to know what Minnesota looked like before we came in and cut down all the trees, Gordon Nerstrand. There it is, right
but
there.
But the irony is, to get to it, you drive through all this farmland.
Well, but former forest,
right.
former
right.
big woods,
yeah.
and you can see, because you've got this farmland, flat, 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 boom, right up to the edge of these big, tall trees.
Right.
And you can see, well, this is what it used to be right here,
right.
and this little section has been saved.
It's crazy to meet people, too, who have property where it backs right up to, say, Nerstrand mm-hmm. Big Woods. Mm-hmm. It backs up straight to, like, a friend of mine who lives in Columbus Township, or Columba Township, Columbus. And he's got the Carlos Avery right off his backyard. He mm-hmm. said, "There's at the right time of year, I can hear deer hunters back there."
Yeah.
You know, he said, "I get a little nervous from time to time." But he said, "It's just amazing to have these huge stands of wood right behind you." You know,
so those areas, we have... We're bouncing all over on topics. Hope you don't mind.
Welcome to cabin country.
It's like sitting around the fire at the cabin and talking. But things like National Wildlife Refuges were something that started very early in the early 1900s and were funded by hunters. And that's something we've lost sight of. So people who hunted and who fished have always paid for hunting licenses, fishing license. Mm-hmm. And that money has gone somewhere, and it's gone to the purchase of lands and then the maintaining of those lands over time. And so if you go to a National Wildlife Refuge or a state refuge, I'm not talking about state parks,
right,
but these refuges, you can go there because of hunters.
Right.
And they're saved because of hunting. And we have to kind of respect that and understand. I don't hunt, but I'm not anti-hunting either. People just need to understand, you know, I'm one of those people who I fear that when we don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And you need to know where things came from. You need to understand and have a big picture of things. Okay, so I'm an educator. You're an educator, mm-hmm. right? We're mm-hmm. educators. And to me, this is where the rubber hits the road. That education, educating people about the environment, about nature, whether it be about birds or bugs or whatever it may be, it's my belief that once you know these things,
right.
once you know it, you know you take better care of it, you make better choices about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing, because if you don't, we make bad decisions. Like, a good example of that is like bats. Everybody thinks how, you know, oh, they don't know anything about bats because they're nocturnal, they don't come out, we don't see them, you know, they're not flying around during the daytime, they're not pretty, they're not bright, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so we come up with all sorts of horror stories about them flying in our hairs and carrying disease and whatever, all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, bats, there's about 5,000 species of mammals in the world. 5,000, it's not a lot. About 1,500 of them is a type of bat.
Oh, wow.
A quarter of all of our mammal species on the earth is a type of bat. And bats are the main pollinators for almost all the fruits that come out of the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
And these are incredible animals that eat tons and tons of insects every single night.
Right.
And yet we vilify them. We think they're horrible. We think they're dirty rats, rats with wings,
rats
and whatever,
wings.
And all sorts of things. And see, that's the problem. But when you learn about bats, when you learn about, you know, the amazing things that they do and how they do them like that, you can't help but to think, wow, that is a cool animal. And you would do something to, hopefully you would make choices that would help perpetuate that species, because our bat species, forget about it. We have 7 species of bats here in Minnesota.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And I always forget this. I can never remember. It's either 3 migrate and 4 stay, or 4 stay and 3 migrate. I can never remember. At any rate. And those species, the ones who stay, all have that white nose syndrome right now, and they are down in the 90-some percent. So 90% of our bats that we used to have are gone right now.
Wow.
So if you're having a lot of mosquitoes around your house, if you're having a lot of bugs around your house, don't complain to the mosquito control. Complain the fact that we don't have any bats who are supposed to be eating all those bugs.
Well, and probably the roundabout way that it comes back to the bats not being around or being in, those that are here are sick, probably has a lot to do with humans.
Well,
messing around with the environment, you know.
There you go.
We can dominate it and pay the price.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Sad, but
and true. And we're going to just continue to make these mistakes over and over and over again until we start to kind of understand our past.
Right.
When you understand the past, you'd make a better future.
Right. Right.
Well, why isn't that a downer? Look at that. Left you guys both speechless after that one.
Slack jawed and
depressed.
Now
this is about the time we crack another beer and go, all right.
Throw a little
more red
oak on the fire.
So how about those twins?
Yeah, they're not playing.
COVID. Anyway, yeah. Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to end here with part one of our talk with Stan Tequila, but we've got another whole hour of Stan sharing his knowledge and passion for the natural world in the next episode, including the curious sex life of birds, so you're not going to want to miss that. The bird sounds heard in this episode are from Stan's 2 audio CD set, Birds of Minnesota, and used with the permission of Stan Tequila and Adventure Publications. You can find this CD set and many of Stan's books for sale on Amazon. Join us on our next episode with part two of our special guest, Stan Tequila, in Cabin Country.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.